Welcome to Striving for Consensus, Current and Future Management of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer in Patients with EGFR Tumor Mutations. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Drs. Passayani, Tom John, Zosia Piotrowska, and Alexander Spira for this think tank-style discussion on relevant data sets and their perspectives on EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. To begin, we chatted about the management of patients with localized disease. So let's talk a little bit before Tom starts presenting the data about kind of your observations of people in practice and how they're reacting to evolving data in the localized disease setting, both adjuvant targeted therapy, particularly EGFR-based and locally advanced. Obviously, we saw some great stuff at the ASCO meeting. Zosia, what are some of the questions you get and some of the issues that come up and when you see second opinions, et cetera, you think people are struggling with, say in the adjuvant setting?
I think in general, I've been really happy to see that these data have translated to clinical practice very quickly. Of course, they translated to approvals quickly, and I think there's been a lot of uptake, particularly of the ADAURA data, even from the initial presentation and then later with the survival data as well. So I think we are seeing this utilized widely in practice. I think there's still a lot of open questions. We are now just past the three-year mark from the initial approval, and so now we're having patients who are reaching the end of that 3 years of adjuvant osimertinib. And so I think an important question that's coming up a lot in our practice and from colleagues in the community is 3 years really the right time? Should we be stopping? And a lot of open questions about whether we should be using any of the novel assays for minimal residual disease or anything else to help us guide that. And unfortunately, right now, we don't have the data to tell us that yet, but hopefully in the future. We saw uptake of LORA as well, I think, or a lot of enthusiasm for LORA at ASCO this year, and I expect that will also be taken up pretty quickly. I think another question that comes up sometimes is uncommon EGFR mutations and how to apply these data to some of the rare mutations. And again, an open question, but right now I think the most important point is to be using these adjuvant therapies or consolidation therapy for the classic mutations.
So, Palsy, another issue that a lot of oncologists bring up, and there's a trial looking at this, but in the meantime, is patients who are lower risk who are actually in the ADAURA trial. People are used to breast cancer. They have endocrine therapy. It's maybe established in higher risk patients, but then they'll use it in lower risk, apply the hazard rate to try to estimate the actual benefit. What do you do yourself in your practice outside of a trial right now, Palsy, with these lower risk patients, and any thoughts about where this is heading?
Well, I do think that is a question that does come up in our clinical practice and from our colleagues around the Boston area. I would say for stage 1B patients, I discussed that with the patients, and there was a benefit, obviously, in that subset as well. In the stage 1A patients, there is an ongoing dedicated trial looking at adjuvant osimertinib, and I mentioned that to patients and have a discussion with them. I don't know that I've had anyone go on adjuvant osimertinib at stage 1A, and I don't know if there would be any insurance-related issues that would come up with that. I would say the biggest question that comes up is exactly what Zosia mentioned, is what do you do at the three-year mark? I'm starting to reach the first patients as well in the three-year mark, and a lot of patients don't want to stop their therapy, and especially if they're tolerating it well and they know it's kind of an insurance policy to reduce the likelihood of recurrence, and so that's not always an easy conversation.
So, Alex, another question that comes up is about adjuvant chemotherapy in these patients. This was used prior to the ADAURA trial, but I see a lot of general oncologists sort of holding back on that and just giving osimertinib. Can you talk about your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and I think this is an area where a lot of us have our own opinions and probably feel very strongly about them. I'm of the ilk of remembering when adjuvant chemotherapy just came out. And the original, it was the IALT data way back, I think, in 03. that showed a benefit, depending on the stage, between 4 to 10%, probably more towards 4, less towards 10, but, you know, small numbers. With that in mind, you know, the average patient, I'm often hard pressed. I mean, we have a targeted therapy that works very well, that is relatively benign. You know, you've alluded to, Neil, you know, whether or not you do beyond 3 years or not. I mean, even a benign drug beyond 3 years has an issue. It's a separate question. I usually am shying away for chemo unless there's a stage three is when I probably where you're trying to go all in for it. In the adjuvant setting, the improvement rate is still probably measured in single digits. And I think when you look at the risk benefit analysis, and I talk to patients about it, of course, it's how you sway them versus, you know, it's what we say, not just what they hear. I'm usually leaning against it unless there's somebody that really want to do anything. I do understand that there's many people that want to pursue it as well for those reasons. And I get it. It's not an easy decision. But for me, the juice is not worth the squeeze, so to speak.
All right. Well, with that as a little bit of a background, why don't we get into your talk, Tom, looking at some of the advances in localized disease?
So thank you for the very kind invitation. I was tasked to present on some recent advances in the management of localized and locally advanced EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. So these are the survival curves that were presented at ASCO last year, showing the updated disease-free survival from the original New England Journal paper, which was updated in the JCO. At that point in time, the hazard ratio was 0.27. This is the ADORA trial where patients were randomized to either receive osimertinib or placebo after completely resected stage 1B to 3A non-small cell lung cancer with EGFR mutations. And there was the option to not have chemotherapy, but most patients with stage 2 and 3 disease did have adjuvant chemotherapy. The benefit of using osimertinib is that it is CNS penetrant. And in these updated analyses, it was clear that patients who received osimertinib had an improvement in their CNS disease-free survival probability. And this probably led to many clinicians adopting it despite overall survival not being available. You can see on these survival curves, the hazard ratio for CNS DFS was 0.24. Now, the overall survival update, this is in stage 1B to 3A. The trial was powered around stage 2 and 3A. This showed an absolute benefit at 5 years of 10% favoring the osimertinib arm. If you look just at the stage 2 and 3A disease, this went up to 12% as an absolute benefit. Obviously, there's quite a lot of censoring, and we're still collecting data on this group of patients, but clearly a benefit in overall survival. Are there biomarkers that can perhaps predict who to treat and who to treat for a period of time? Well, these were some data that were presented at ASCO, and this is looking at minimal residual disease. So just again, this is the trial design for ADORA, and in the box is the scan schedule and the ctDNA plasma sampling schedule, which you can see are slightly off kilter. The ctDNA sampling was done more frequently in the initial 3 years, and then at the 3 year mark, so it was every 12 weeks and then went to every 12 and 24 weeks and then every 52 weeks therein, whereas the scans were less frequent. And so in this analysis, we look to see whether you could predict patients likely to recur based on MRD. The MRD analysis we chose was called RADAR. It's an assay that relies on whole exome sequencing the primary tumor. So you need a decent tumor sample to begin with, and you exclude germline variants. Design a specific customized panel for each patient, and then you can use that customized panel at subsequent time points. When we did this, we were able to look at 242 patients, 112 in the osimertinib arm and 108 in the placebo arm. You can see 91% of patients, the analysis was successful. This really is one of the key outcomes from the study. These are MRD events MRD events in the osimertinib compared to the placebo arm. The osimertinib is shaded in blue for the three-year time point and then grey thereafter. And each circle represents an MRD time point. And again, you can see fairly clearly here that patients who have MRD events are more likely to be in the placebo arm. They're shaded red, each positive MRD event. And in purple are those where there is a DFS event. And pretty much you can see the MRD event precedes the DFS event in most patients. 13% of osimertinib-treated patients developed an MRD event compared to 49% in the placebo arm. The number of patients who were positive at baseline, not surprisingly, they were more likely to be more advanced stage, so stage 2 and stage 3. Chemotherapy didn't seem to make a difference, although there does seem to be more stage 2 patients who did not receive chemotherapy who were MRD positive. But in the stage 3 patients, you can see 5% and 8% respectively in patients who did and didn't receive chemotherapy. So doesn't particularly tell you which patients are going to do better. And again, when we look at who develops an MRD event, in the osimertinib arm, most patients don't develop an event while they're on osimertinib. Most of these events occur at the point of stopping, and most of those occur within the first 12 months. Some also occur at the 2-year mark. And if you compare that to the placebo, most patients, only 31% of patients did not develop an MRD event or a DFS event in the placebo arm, really highlighting the benefit of osimertinib. So could this be used to pick patients to escalate or de-escalate treatment? I think potentially yes, after you've completed your therapy. If you're MRD positive prior to osimertinib, I think this tells you that you have stage 4 disease really, and you really should continue the osimertinib probably lifelong. If you're MRD during osimertinib, you're more likely to have developed a resistance mutation to the OSI. If you're MRD positive post-osimertinib, these patients, they're more likely to recur, but there's around a 5-month window, a lead time between the MRD event and the scan event. So you could potentially restart based on MRD. But the real question is, can we actually predict who the bad players are up front? And at the moment, we don't have that answer. There are some ongoing trials, including NEO-ADORA. This is having neoadjuvant osimertinib. I'll just show you that design briefly in a second. The ADORA 2 study is this is a phase 3 study looking at stage 1A patients. And then the phase 2 target study is looking at 5 years of osimertinib instead of 3 years. This is the NEO-ADORA trial schema. So patients that have resectable stage 2 and 3B disease are randomized 1:1:1 to either placebo and chemo, OSI plus chemo or OSI alone, followed by surgery. You see they're looking for major pathological and complete pathological response. And then there's the option to have adjuvant treatment beyond that.
I'm curious, Zosia, right now, I'm going to guess you're not ordering it outside of trial, but I'm also going to guess you might see people getting some type of assay done. Right? Will you look at that? Will you take that into consideration? Are there any situations right now where you think it would affect clinical decision making? And more importantly, where do you see this heading? It was a really great slide there at the end where, depending on where the MRD is, you may, that whole future look at that. What are your thoughts, Zosia?
Yeah, I think these are really intriguing and important data. You know, in short answer, I'm not yet using it routinely in clinical practice. You know, I think that there's a lot of open questions still. What is the right assay to use? Is it a tumor-informed assay? You know, could we use a non-tumor-informed assay, or will the limitations of sensitivity be an issue there? And importantly, you know, how do we act upon these data? Is it really, if we find an MRD event, you know, is it beneficial to those patients if there's no disease recurrence on scans to restart the TKI then? Or, you know, would they do just as well if we wait some time? So I think there right now there's still many open questions, but I will say I have patients who are hearing about these data and asking these questions, and the assays are out there. So I think the reality is that this is here to stay. And the main thing that we have to figure out together is what is the best way to use this? And can we be smarter about really personalizing this therapy and identifying that subset of patients who maybe need a, you know, a longer treatment approach. And I also wonder whether the data from Laura, where patients got indefinite osimertinib until progression, will kind of bleed over into the adjuvant setting, and whether that will increase our enthusiasm for a longer course of TKI therapy. I personally would really like to know which patients need that rather than to, you know, doing it for everyone.
Kind of curious, Posse, I'm talking to your breast cancer colleagues, Drs. Burstein, Tulaney, et cetera, all the time about a trial there where they're looking in patients on adjuvant endocrine therapy for the development of ESR1 mutations, and they're actually randomizing between changing treatment at that point to a different agent, a SERD. Do you see that potentially happening in the future here in lung cancer?
I think that's a potential here as well, and I think that one couple of challenges, first of all, when do you do that change? Do you do it kind of as Zosia alluded to, do you change or continue treatment if you see something in the ctDNA but not anything in the scans? Is that the right time to change or not? And then here I think it would also depend on what do you change to, because resistance comes in multiple flavors to osimertinib, and you'd have to have a consistent strategy, I think, as to what to change it to. And is that chemotherapy? Is that an ADC? Is that something else in the future? So I think a question that will continue to arise, and I think from both the DORA and the LORA, we'll continue to have these questions about durability or duration of treatment, rather, and also when to change therapies or to stop therapies for that matter.
I guess, Alex, it also really gets into the question of how effective is osimertinib in the variety of mutations that are out there. There's so many out there. Even the difference between exon 19 and L858R. Any thoughts about whether newer TKIs or combining things with TKI and other agents with TKIs? Any thoughts about that type of strategy, Alex?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot that goes into this, and I think those are all good strategies. I think the challenge you run into, and we'll allude to some of this in my presentation, is increasing toxicity, right? I mean, I think we all know that osimertinib is probably one of the easiest drugs to give. And as we add in other EGFR inhibitors, yeah, they work better, or they may work better, or they may work in combination, but that comes at a price. So I think those are going to be some of the challenges that you have for some of these things. You know, we were learning a lot about some of the atypical EGFR mutations. We've talked about that at a previous meeting we've done. I think we need to learn a lot about some of these other mutations and really nail those down, because OC is not approved for many of those, the exon 18s being the most common one of those. So I think there's a lot out there. I think the newer ones are very interesting, but I do have some concerns about their toxicity.
All right, let's continue with the LARA data, Tom.
Yeah, sure. And we'll talk a little bit about adherence in LORA. And certainly across the board, we seem to think of osimertinib as being incredibly well tolerated, but you do see quite a few dose interruptions as well as withdrawals, but it's still a minority of patients. So the LORA study is building on the ADORA study. This is now a group of patients who have unresectable stage 3 disease. So, and this is using a different version of the AJCC staging. So just bear that in mind between ADORA and LORA. So this is now stage 3A, B, and C disease. Patients were randomized to either osimertinib or placebo on a 2-to-1 randomization. And as we've intimated, the treatment continued until progression. So this is sort of accepting that this is non-curative primary endpoint, progression-free survival, and presented just recently at ASCO in the plenary session to a standing ovation. Patient disposition is shown here. So most patients on the osimertinib arm, you can see just with the median follow-up of 22 months compared to 5.6 months in the placebo arm. And interestingly, crossover to osimertinib in the placebo arm occurred in 81% of patients, which is probably going to make overall survival a difficult endpoint to interpret. Here's the progression-free survival, clearly showing a very significant improvement in PFS for the osimertinib-treated patients, hazard ratio of 0.16. You can see those landmark time points at 2 years. Only 13% of patients are progression-free in the placebo arm compared to 65% in the osimertinib arm. 13% is quite low, and certainly that's one of our questions is, you know, did the control arm do considerably worse? They probably did compared to the Pacific trial, but note that the staging is a little bit different. I've just put up here the comparison for stage 3A with ADAURA. So people are asking, well, should we be resecting these patients? It's a different group of patients, so I don't think you can really interpret this. But the surgical resection for stage 3A patients, those patients do seem to do better with surgery followed by OSI compared to chemo-RADS, but obviously you can't really compare those two directly. So the issues that have been raised around LAURA, PET scans weren't mandated. I don't personally think that's an issue, is that it would have occurred across both arms of the study. The lifelong osimertinib is accepting that this is not curative. As I said, 56% interrupted osimertinib, but only 13% discontinued. The control arm did do worse, but I think that is EGFR mutant lung cancer. This is, this is the best data we have for this. And people have been asking, does the chemo radiation add anything in this group of patients, or could you just put them on osimertinib? Personally, I think it does add, but I'd be very interested to hear what everyone else thinks.
So before you get into your cases, can you talk a little bit more? Maybe I can just go to Zosia about the types of toxicities you see in this situation, and particularly the issue of pneumonitis in these people who had recent chemo radiation therapy.
Yeah, it was an interesting data set, I think, regarding safety. You know, in LAURA, they separated radiation pneumonitis from ILD events. And I would think, you know, that it's valid to separate those. But in clinical practice, I think the two can be quite overlapping. And sometimes it's hard to distinguish what is truly a radiation-related pneumonitis versus, you know, what is interstitial lung disease that's at least in part related to the TKI. And I think, you know, the challenge, of course, is you can treat these patients with steroids, but what does that mean for the TKI therapy? And, you know, I think if we're really truly convinced that this was purely related to radiation alone, then one can make the argument to, you know, continue or resume TKI therapy after steroids, but a lot of times it's not so clear cut. And so I think these are decisions that are not going to be as kind of straightforward and as easy to divide into those two buckets in true clinical practice. And it's something that we'll have to, you know, see evolve and as we treat more patients after chemo-RT with osimertinib.
Kind of curious, Palsy, how you see people going through post-chemo radiation osimertinib compared to durvalumab in terms of, you know, the toxicity profiles.
Well, the toxicity profiles, of course, of durvalumab and osimertinib are different, although both can give pneumonitis as a toxicity. And as Zosia mentioned, sometimes it's difficult to separate out whether that is just a prolonged or delayed radiation pneumonitis or whether the agent used in the adjuvant setting contributed to that. And that has obviously implications for durability of treatment. If it's from the agent, we tend to stop the therapy, at least until pneumonitis has completely resolved or treated with steroids, et cetera. And that may be more of a challenge in the immunotherapy space, where that can also have perhaps negative implications to efficacy of a drug like durvalumab, less so for osimertinib. So I think these are toxicities that will continue to come, and we'll need to continue to monitor and be aware of them in development management plans, especially for in the LORA setting, since the treatment, as Tom mentioned, in the trial was indefinite. It wasn't like in the ADAURA situation where it was for a predefined period of time.
All right. Well, let's see whether we can get through these cases in 5 minutes. I'm kind of wondering, particularly this first one you've got here, Tom. So, Alex, maybe you can comment after you hear this case.
Thank you. So this is very, very topical, and I'll be very interested to hear what everyone thinks. So this is a 55-year-old, very fit and well lady who presented with several months of cough and shortness of breath, a mild degree of hemoptysis, and then had developed some pain in her ribs, hadn't required any medications, not pleuritic, no other symptoms, but it was the pain that led her to actually presenting. So at presentation, the you can see there's a primary lesion in the left lung, and nodal uptake in the 4L node, but there's also an area in the pleura which you can see on the sagittal imaging. And the pathology, actually the 4L ended up being negative on EBUS. The 4R was positive for adenocarcinoma, and the hilum was positive. She ended up having an EGFR exon 19 deleted tumor, but also had a TP53 and KEAP1 mutant tumor. So given the 4R involvement, our radiation oncologist felt that the fields were too big, so she was commenced on osimertinib alone. She ended up having a very impressive response to osimertinib, which you can see there on the PET scan. It was a near complete metabolic response. And so we discussed with her whether we should take a more aggressive approach, given the co-mutations, that she was fit and well. She was very keen to do more. Our radiation oncologist felt that the disease was a lot more encompassable, and so she went on to chemo radiation. So this is before the LORA data was presented, I must add. And then the osimertinib was held during the radiotherapy. Here's the radiotherapy field, so 60 gray to the target dose. And, you know, it's she had the sort of toxicities that you'd expect, some mild dysphagia, and then developed a cough and some pneumonitis, which responded to prednisolone, and she was able to continue on the osimertinib. And this is sort of where she's up to. She's now post chemo radiation. You can see she's developed some mild radiation pneumonitis there on the left, certainly nothing in the right lung. And then that's the CT scan sort of showing the same thing, very much within the radiation field. So we're pretty comfortable that this was not osimertinib related. And her current progress is, because of the ongoing need for steroids, she's been switched to mycophenolate clinically very well. She's weaning her steroids and maintains this complete metabolic response. So you can see the last PET scan there is 14 months after commencing therapy.
So any questions for Alex?
So, you know, I think this is one of those, you know, I think a lot of us do this. I think we're a little bit without data in terms of how aggressive to be with locally aggressive care in these patients. It's certainly something we would all have done. I mean, essentially you gave the patient a neoadjuvant approach and you're able to encompass most, if not all, the tumor in the radiation field. So I think it's something, a very reasonable approach to do. And certainly we've done, it would be great to get data on some of these situations. I realize that's going to be very hard because patients will have their, and physicians will have their own opinion on how aggressive to be with local management.
All right, let's take a look at your next case.
So this is an adjuvant case. Is it probably a little bit more straightforward? 48-year-old man now, fit well, no past medical history, presented with hemoptysis, found to have this lesion in the right lung, and proceeded to surgery. At surgery, he ended up having a PT2N1 adenocarcinoma, so one of 14 lymph nodes were positive. It was acinar predominant, but 20% micropapillary, low PD-L1 and a EGFR mutation with an exon 19 deletion. We ended up putting him on a study, which I'll talk to briefly. There were no co-mutations. He had ctDNA taken, which was negative. This is the study. It's an investigator-led study run through TOGA on the PI for this study. Patients who have resectable EGFR mutant lung cancer who have no co-mutations, and we're mainly looking at TP53. So if you're TP53 negative, we certainly feel you can get rid of chemotherapy, so that those patients are placed into cohort one. If you have TP53 or any other co-mutations, you're just getting standard of care chemotherapy followed by osimertinib. So this patient, because he had no co-mutations and his ctDNA was negative, we've omitted the chemotherapy. He's only just, just began this treatment. The trial's still recruiting, so we'll await to see what happens.
So, Shu, we were talking before about the question of whether to use adjuvant chemotherapy. Do you look at any biomarkers in making that decision, or is it just more clinical?
For me right now, I would say it's mostly clinical. I think these types of risk-adapted approaches are going to be very important to try to understand going forward. But in the absence of data from trials like this, which I agree are really important to do, I think a lot of it comes down to clinical factors, the age, the overall kind of health and well-being of the patient, the patient's feelings about, kind of therapy. A lot of these patients are young and very, very healthy and kind of come in saying, I will do whatever, might possibly improve my outcomes in any way. And on the converse, I've also had patients who are maybe older or have some medical comorbidities where we were on the fence about chemotherapy. And those patients, I think having the presence of an EGFR mutation is really helpful because it gives us kind of, the opportunity to say, well, we have this TKI therapy that we know is beneficial, and that might be enough to sway us away from chemotherapy. So to me, I think the clinical factors, the patient factors right now in day-to-day practice until these data come out are the best way to make these decisions.
So I think we can move on now and talk about first-line therapy of a metastatic disease. I think probably this is the area of most questions right now in terms of docs in practice. I just want to start out with you, Alex, and maybe just sort of frame some of the thoughts you have when you're thinking through this decision nowadays.
It's become very complicated, as they say, with a lot of different options for patients and probably even more coming in the future. I think the theme of the presentation that I think we'll all agree on is, we're blessed in that we have multiple different options for patients. And it's going to come down to that balance of toxicity, patient desire, what does a patient want, and how do we approach this on a very individualized basis. I'll talk a little bit today, I'll allude to during the presentation. We're trying to look at other factors of, who might do better with more intensification therapy. And I think that at least the preliminary data will suggest that it's patients with higher risk disease. But even with that, how much is it worthwhile? Because you're competing against a very well tolerated single agent oral drug that patients have Zosha alluded to very well before, these patients still have real side effects. We've all heard that from our patient advocates, and it's a reminder of that, especially in the adjuvant setting. But how much of the trade-off is going to be worthwhile for patients that might benefit from more intensive therapy, and how do we sort that out on a very individualized basis? And there's no right or wrong answer. And I think this is going to be driven a lot by the physician's desires, because at the end of the day, we're the one that influences what a patient, and it's all how you talk to a patient around that. And I think the conclusion will be, we have a lot of better options, but for whom?
We'll dive into this a little more after we see the data, but just to sort of continue along the same line, Tom, can you talk about maybe specifically what the three main options are? You know, let's put aside reimbursement, assume you can access anything. You know, just really, let's try to analyze it from the point of view of risk benefit. And let me just start by saying, how does the presence of brain mets affect the decision for you?
Yeah, brain mets, I think, makes a big difference for me, because the data from which I assume we're going to talk through from FLORA2, but also from the amivantamab studies, is showing a benefit to patients who have brain mets with combination approaches. I think not every single patient needs to have a combination approach, but there are there does seem to be some patients who would probably benefit from more intensification of their therapy. But it does come with extra toxicities, and I think that the things we need to balance out when we're talking about these combination therapies.
So just to push it a little bit farther, Zosia, from your point of view, can you talk, I mean, imagine you're, you know, presenting this to a first year fellow. Can you talk about sort of the differences in terms of quality of life, tolerability, toxicity, lifestyle in these various approaches? And, you know, how you mentioned age before, how does age or, you know, even performance status affect the decision?
Yeah, I think, you know, right now in 2024, we essentially, you know, again, taking out of the equation of reimbursement and approval, we have three kind of treatment options based on positive phase three studies. We have osimertinib monotherapy from the FLORA trial. We have the combination of first line osimertinib with platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy from the FLORA2 trial. And then we have the combination of amivantamab, a bispecific antibody targeting EGFR and MET, with lazertinib, which is another third generation EGFR inhibitor, very similar to osimertinib based on the Mariposa study. Both of these, FLORA2 and Mariposa, have shown significant improvements in progression-free survival, but neither study has yet shown an overall survival improvement with these combinations. And of course, we're looking at cross-trial comparisons of these three. And I would say that, you know, they're quite different in terms of the patient experience. Of course, we're all familiar with osimertinib monotherapy. As we alluded to, this is generally, you know, fairly well tolerated for most patients. Patients come to clinic relatively infrequently, once every few months. You know, they take a pill once a day. And for most patients, I think they live fairly normal lives. Once you start adding combinations, you know, the combinations are all IV. They require additional clinic visits and close monitoring. With chemotherapy, that's, of course, visits, you know, with platinum pemetrexed every 3 weeks. Although I will note that in FLORA2, not all patients continued pemetrexed maintenance for the duration of their time on osimertinib. Many of these patients eventually kind of tailored off the chemotherapy altogether. But there are the toxicities of chemotherapy, fatigue, myelosuppression that you have to be aware of. And then the amivantamab combination, I think, has a unique and different safety profile. You know, there in particular, we see infusion-related reactions with the first infusion, although I think that'll likely be less common with the subcutaneous formulations. We see dermatologic toxicities, which can, with in combination with TKIs, be quite significant for some of these patients, scalp issues, paronychia, things like that, that can have a big impact on quality of life. And the infusions there are every 2 weeks. So, you know, there's really pros and cons to each of these. The experience is different. And I think, to me, the first question is it a patient who should really just get osimertinib monotherapy, or should we think about a combination? And then a second, maybe, conversation about which combination between these different options, once, you know, they're all FDA approved, would be the best one for individual patients based on the data, based on patient preference. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, age, patient kind of comorbidities, and patient preference are going to play an important role in these. These are going to be long and I think complicated discussions for some of these patients in the clinic. But I think we have to help guide patients to what we think is likely to be that best first line therapy.
Palsy, could you talk a little bit more about the tolerability toxicity issues that come up with amivantamab? And Zosia referred to the sub-Q that was presented at ASCO. I'm curious what effect you see there. You know, in myeloma, we saw such a gigantic, and other situations in oncology where you go from IV to sub-Q, daratumumab, huge difference in terms of infusion time, obviously, et cetera. Any thoughts about that, Palsy?
Well, I think the infusion reactions are going to be fewer, as was demonstrated in that trial at ASCO. And I think that has some practical implications for the clinic to be able to administer it subcutaneously and avoid the infusion reactions and sometimes the chaos that that ensues after having an infusion reaction. And I think it allows the therapy to be more widely disseminated into practices where they may not be used to infusion reactions like seen with amivantamab or other molecules like it. It doesn't, of course, take away the on-target toxicities, the EGFR, wild-type EGFR inhibition toxicities. So the paronychia, the skin rash, et cetera, will still be there and need their own management algorithms to either prevent them or treat them at the earliest sign of onset. So I think those will still continue to be present there, but I think the infusion reaction and just clinic flow will be improved by the subcutaneous formulation.
All right, let's take a look at some of the data. Alex, if you can go through that.
So we'll start with the simple, and I guess, you know, this is old news for some, now 6 years old, but here's the standard of care from Flora, which, you know, is to remind everybody, before osimertinib, there were other drugs. There was gefitinib and erlotinib that were the standard of care, depending where you are in the country, around the world, rather. And here's the original data from that study, 2018, updated in 2020. And as you can see, the improvement in overall survival here, 38 versus 31 months in terms of outcomes. And again, looking at the PFS, PFS, as expected, was even more important. Lots of subgroup analyses were done on this study. Looking at CNS, there was improvement in CNS outcomes. So lots of improvement in outcomes, no matter how you look at it, that osimertinib is just a better drug. Here's the CNS data, as you can see. So the patients did much better if they had CNS metastases as well. Not a surprise. We've all learned over time that osimertinib has much better CNS penetration than did the previous generation of drugs. To me, the most important thing is really the toxicity. And again, some of us have grown up with these drugs, even previous generation of drugs. Very complicated slide here, as you can see. But if you really look at it, the incidence, and I think our clinical acumen, looking at incidence of diarrhea, rash, and the general malaise people have in this is much improved with osimertinib. I think, you know, we see the data here, but in my experience, it actually is even better. I mean, looking at these drugs and having given them, the overall side effects from osimertinib, much better drug. And this quickly moved to the standard of care, where I think in almost all the world, maybe except for a few holdouts, osimertinib has emerged as the standard of care for all this. And we're very used to giving it and the dosing. Taking some of Posse's thunder away here. Posse was a co-author on the study and presented some of it. But looking at Flora 2, and here we had the improvement. So this was now asking a very simple question. So let's look at the frontline therapy. What happens if we add on chemotherapy? So you would add on chemotherapy, platinum-based, carboplatin, pemetrexed to osimertinib versus osimertinib alone. And as you can see, there's an improvement in outcomes, no matter how you look at it. Looking at improvement, progression-free analysis, investigator-assessed versus the blinded, the Burke review, blind independent central review. And as you can see, there are improvements here, 25 versus 16 locally, 29 versus 19 centrally. Clearly some differences there, but nevertheless, there were some improvements here. And, you know, some people were surprised by it. Some people were not. The exact etiology, this is unclear, whether or not we're actually driving down tumor burden, whether or not you're preventing emergence of resistance clones, unknown. But we can see here the clear improvement with the addition of chemotherapy. PFS and the CNS actually improved as well. So as you can see here, the orange versus the blue curves, similar story. Progression-free survival with CNS or without CNS at outcome, both patient populations did better. And this has always kind of been, you know, a very important endpoint in patients with EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. Of course, you know, which subgroups benefited more, and you saw pretty much benefit across all subgroups. Maybe ECOG zero probably crossed the barrier a little bit more than the other ones. But as you can look from the hazard ratios, most everybody here benefited, no matter how it was broken down on these pre-specified analysis. So again, chemotherapy has improvement in outcomes. Of course, you see improvement in adverse events. It's not a surprise. We've been giving carboplatin pemetrexed for very, very long time. So there's no surprise here. biggest side effect toxicity is the chemo side effects you would see. Anemia, not a surprise. We know that chemo causes anemia. Clearly increase in white cell count decrease as well as a neutrophil count increase. Some of this is paper toxicity, some of it's not, right? People do have increased toxicity when you give them chemotherapy, and you saw that bearing out in fatigue. There's obviously the non-CTCAE criteria of coming to the clinic more often, right? These patients have to come in to get their chemotherapy and really not accounting for it. But overall, I don't think there's any surprises here. No untoward side effects. We'll now talk about amivantamab. So amivantamab is a unique drug. It's been talked about at length, I'm sure, at many of these think tanks. We've heard about it a lot. But it works in multiple different ways, and it's really tough to break down which is the most important mechanism of action. To remind everybody, it's an antibody against EGFR and c-MET. So it binds both of these. It's a two-headed antibody, as I like to describe it. It is a naked antibody. So it is not an antibody-drug conjugate. But it can work in a couple of ways. It can block ligand-antibody activation, so essentially blocking the external part in the cell surface, so preventing EGFR from binding. Once it binds, it causes receptor internalization and degradation, so EGFR can no longer signal. And there's ADCC-induced trogocytosis. I laugh because I didn't know about trogocytosis in medical school. It did not exist, I think, through a few years ago. But in essence, binds with macrophages and NK cells to bind the cell surface and cause immune activation as well. One of the most important things that we have to think about is secondary resistance is a major cause of TKI resistance. And you can think about it as well. So as you think about one of the major causes of TKI resistance is c-MET, C797S, this would in theory prevent that from happening because you're binding c-MET and EGFR. So in my mind, the most important thing is preventing or delaying the onset of that by number one, but we don't know which one of these is more important than others. So the Mariposa study is a very standard clinical study, really going to focus on the first two cohorts, AmiLAZ versus osimertinib. Lazertinib was just in there to prove that lazertinib, the TKI here, is as good as osimertinib in a specified analysis. So the main endpoints here are looking at first-line EGFR or L858R mutated non-small cell lung cancer and comparing amivantamab, lazertinib, I'll abbreviate it as AmiLAZ, versus osimertinib. And the typical secondary endpoints are seen here. So as you can see here, PFS on the top compared with osimertinib. And as you can see, there was a significant improvement in PFS compared with the osimertinib group at the top. At the bottom, you see some of the comparison versus lazertinib, but really focusing on the top, 23 versus 16.6 months. So it appears that you have an improvement in progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.7 with a significant p-value. So I'm sure we'll get into how do you compare this to chemotherapy in a few minutes, but in my mind, not dramatically different compared with the FLAURA2 data. Looking at some of the subgroup analyses, as you can see here, pretty much across the board, you see AmiLAZ is better than osimertinib, not a significant difference depending on which subgroup that you're looking at. We'll talk a little bit about osimertinib versus AmiLAZ and the overall survival. Could not be estimated. We are beginning to see the separation of the curves here with a hazard ratio of 0.8. Could not be estimated right now, early analysis. We think there might be some hints of improvements here, and hopefully by the next analysis when we reach enough events, there may be improvement in overall survival. At least now, all we can say, there's a trend in OS to be determined. Now looking at adverse events, and here is obviously very similar to the FLAURA2 study. As you can expect, there's an increase in adverse events. Here you're seeing the typical, as Posse alluded to before, the EGFR wild type events. So paronychia, infusion-related reactions, which, again, as was alluded to before, may be going away, we hope, as the subcutaneous formulation gets hopefully rid of that. You are seeing probably more rash, 62% versus 31%. If you've given this drug, there's not a surprise there. Hypoalbuminemia is one of the big ones, and it is not just a paper toxicity. We know that all the MET drugs drive hypoalbuminemia and edema, but you are seeing increased edema here. And for some patients, this can be very significant as well. As you can see, lots of increased side effects. So again, no surprises here. Alluded to some of the EGFR wild-type toxicities, but again, as would we expect, given the mechanism of action of amivantamab. We'll now look at some of the secondary analyses, looking at brain metastases, and not a surprise here, some of the secondary analyses presented by Dr. Philippe in abstract form. You are seeing some patients with a history of brain metastases do better on the with or without, so not a surprise here. So you know that this is very similar to some of the chemotherapy data as well. And again, what this analysis was done, I'll get to some of these in detail. This is actually, some of this just been published in the Annals of Oncology, but what's been looking at here is who might benefit? Who do you think might benefit from intensification of therapy? And one of the things we've always thought about is people with higher burden disease. Liver metastases, although happening, is relatively uncommon. We've all thought about it as increased risk of progression. The patients don't do as well. And as you can see here, patients with baseline liver metastases do have improvement when you give them amivantamab as well. So the two subgroups, brain metastases and liver metastases, both do better here. One of the big things, TP53 co-mutations versus wild type. Patients with P53 co-mutations, patients with did worse, did do better with the addition of amivantamab. A little bit better with wild type, though not as dramatic as well. And again, one of the big things that we looked at is who has detectable baseline circulating tumor DNA. Again, higher burden of disease. Patients with higher burden of disease by measured by circulating tumor DNA, we believe did do better. Patients without detectable circulating tumor DNA did better as well. So again, looking at some of these subgroups also. One of the big things I think Zosia talked about, and I think one of the big studies being done at several institutions, I think Memorial with Helena is leading one of these as well. Patients who did not clear circulating tumor DNA, we always thought these patients did worse. And patients who did not clear the circulating tumor DNA clearly did better with AMI-LAS versus OC. And as you can look here, that's significant. Patients who didn't clear the circulating tumor DNA, 9 months of PFS here, so relatively small. And again, no surprises here. So again, this subsequent abstract really reinforces that patients with high risk subgroups did do better with the combination. Of course, everybody did better with the combination as well. So that's where we are right now, and where we hope to see, and is where we are in terms of the three treatments. And I'm sure we'll talk about which treatments do people like to give and where are people's mindsets right now.
Maybe we can kind of get into that clinical issue by looking at your cases, beginning with this 47-year-old patient. What happened there? And maybe Zosia can respond to this case.
Yeah, so this is a very straightforward clinical trial patient. So it's a 47-year-old non-smoker who presented with a cough, had exon 19 deletion, so the mutation that we think does better than L858R, had bone and lung metastases, did not have brain metastases. And when I sat down with him, I said, hey, what do you want to do? And, you know, he wanted to be as aggressive as he possibly could. And you can say the patient did not have a high burden of disease here. So this patient did not have a high burden of disease, did not have liver metastases, had relatively small lung mat as well, but wanted to be treated on amivantamab and lazertinib. And we talked to him about the risk of embarking on a clinical study. He's currently on and actually doing relatively well with a reasonable response. And one can argue this is a patient that did not have a very significant burden of disease as we might think about some of those subgroups.
So before you comment, Zosia, just can you talk a little bit more about exactly what happened or what's happening when he was on treatment in terms of toxicity?
Yeah, so he did very well. He had the typical TKI side effects. He had, as everybody else did, a grade 1 reaction on the first day. We got him through it. I cannot remember if we had to give him the full dose on the first day. Remember, when you're giving an IV, there's a loading dose day 1 and the subsequent completion on day 2. He's had a rash that he could manage. It's grade 1, worse on the scalp. He's on a couple of shampoos right now. He's tolerating things reasonably well. He has not yet progressed, but doing well, reasonably well overall. But again, some of the major side effects that one would expect to see, so nothing untoward.
So Zosia, any comments and any thoughts? You mentioned before younger patients who want to do as much as possible. What do you think about in that kind of situation?
Yeah, and maybe a question first, Alex. The decision, you know, once you kind of get to the patient wants to try to go for a combination if possible, how did you talk about chemotherapy as well as an option, or why specifically the choice for the Mariposa regimen here?
Oh, so we had Mariposa open at the time. So this patient was on it for a while. So we had Mariposa. And at that point, Flora 2 either was closed or not open. I can't remember because it's been a while. I think it was closed at that time. So the decision for point for him was OC versus trial.
Yeah. So I think this is a perfect illustration of a patient, a young, healthy patient, as many of these patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer are, who come in and say, you know, I don't just want the TKI. I want the next best thing. I want to, you know, kind of take the most aggressive approach. And I think combination therapy in those patients is very appropriate, you know, even outside of a high disease burden, to really kind of induce the maximal response and hopefully the longest duration of response. In my practice, I think, you know, outside of having the Mariposa trial open, I think, you know, a chemotherapy combination would be also very reasonable in a patient like this. Of course, today, we actually only have the Flora 2 regimen available, you know, outside of a trial. So I think I'd probably, you know, talk to this patient about osimertinib plus chemotherapy. But in the future, I think that, you know, once Mariposa is approved, both would be very reasonable. I think that, you know, the data for amivantamab is quite compelling. And I think there is certainly going to be a role for this drug at some point in these patients' disease trajectories. And I think some of the question may be a little bit of a sequencing question as to, you know, when can we access these therapies? If we give them amivantamab first line, might that save chemotherapy for the future? Conversely, you know, perhaps if we have access to amivantamab in a later line setting, either with chemotherapy or on a trial, that may be okay as well. So I think there's a little bit of a discussion too about strategizing, you know, the best way for these patients to access the most therapies, and hopefully for amivantamab to be a part of that patient's treatment course.
So Tom, again, sort of putting aside reimbursement and regulatory issues, can you talk a little bit about how you think through this decision? And, you know, we talked about the younger patient who wants everything done. What about the 75 or 80 year old patient who wants everything done?
Yeah, it's a good point. I don't think there's a clear answer. We've got all these subset analyses that have been done post hoc, which, you know, at the end of the day, when you have a young 47-year-old fit young person, you know, a lot of those subset analyses sort of go out the door, because you're effectively, we're trying to be as aggressive as possible in terms of clearance. I would love to know some other factors about this patient. I would love to know, you know, whether there were co-mutations. There was some really nice data recently published from Charlie Swanton's group around TP53 and mixed responses to osimertinib, you know, really showing that there's actually genome doubling in those patients, and it's associated with a poorer response to osimertinib and a mixed response to osimertinib. You know, I think if we knew things like that, so co-mutation status, if we knew about ctDNA positivity also associated with poorer outlook up front, then yes, I would be driven more towards using a combination approach. It's fair to say, and I think we've sort of touched on it, that the AMI-LAS combination toxicities are very different to the chemotherapy toxicities. You know, paronychia and skin tox in particular can be quite difficult to manage, and certainly you need to be on top of it up front. So when this is readily available, I think we're going to need to be a lot more aggressive in toxicity management. Chemotherapy is we're probably a lot more familiar with, and so those toxicities, I think we're a lot better at managing. And as Zosia indicated, a lot of patients stop the chemotherapy on the Flora 2 study after 6 cycles, and you know, there was still that survival, or disease-free survival, sorry, progression-free survival benefit in that group of patients. So I think if we had ideally, if I had a lot more information up front, rather than just the mutation and the sites of disease, I mean, sites of disease definitely come into it, liver, brain. But if I also knew about co-mutations and ctDNA, that would definitely influence the therapeutic paradigm that I would approach this with.
So, Alex, before you go into your next case, any thoughts after having heard your colleagues comment on this first case?
Yeah, I mean, so this is somebody that if it was not enrolling in a clinical study, I would probably push them to osimertinib single agent, just because of the tolerability and the toxicity and the time in clinic. I mean, knowing where we are in terms of the data right now.
Great point. All right, let's go take a look at your next case.
So this is a relatively straightforward patient, just met a couple months ago. So it's a 53-year-old woman who presented with each L858R, multiple subcentimeter lung metastases, really had a minimal cough from this, and it's quite surprising. You can't see the little tiny lung metastases except if you have a microscope, but they're there on some of the other images. But that's the big lung mass that we're seeing. So she's a minimally symptomatic school bus driver, four children, didn't really want to intensify her therapy. So we just put her on osimertinib single agent. She's done very well. The mass here has shrunken just a little bit. There's probably a little bit of atelectasis. All those little tiny nodules, those subcentimeter things have resolved, and she's doing really well, and she's able to work full time. So for her, it was all about quality of life. She did not have a high burden of disease, didn't have brain metastases. She does have L858R, which in my mind was a little bit of a worse prognosis from what we know, but she's doing well so far. And for her, it was about being able to keep her quality of life going, not come into the clinic and be with her kids.
So, Pussy, any biologic explanation for why people with L858R don't seem to do quite as well as exon 19? And in general, when you think about co-mutations and the primary mutations, what variability do you see in response to osimertinib?
Well, we certainly learned that from the FLORA trial, that patients who have the L858R mutation don't derive the improvement in OS as compared to those with the exon 19 deletion. And as such, it's felt to be perhaps not as good of a, or not as responsive to osimertinib mutation. Usually the PFS is shorter with the L858R mutation as well compared to the exon 19 deletion. Part of that's probably biological. Part of that's pharmacology, meaning I think osimertinib is just a better inhibitor of the exon 19 deletion compared to the L858R, and that may be why we're seeing some of these clinical differences. But I do think that moving forward, gathering data on these trials to show whether the combination also improves the outcome for patients with L858R as well as exon 19 deletions will be important. We know from both FLORA2 and MARIPOSA that indeed is the case. So it's one of the things that goes into certainly the decision-making about a single agent versus combination. And Alex, it sounds like in this case, there were no co-mutations. And I don't know if you did or did not check for ctDNA.
There were no co-mutations. We didn't check for clearance. The patient had a Guardant that was positive, so it was positive at baseline based upon that. But we didn't check for clearance. We're not doing that routinely right now.
Certainly a feature that positive ctDNA we know is a poor prognostic factor and certainly something that could go into the decision-making about a combination versus a single agent.
Zosia, do you take that into consideration? Are you more likely to offer combination therapy with somebody with L858R?
I think it's a factor that I try to take in the context of other risk factors. The way that I think about it now is the more of these various risk factors someone might accumulate, the more likely I am to think about a combination. So L858R, the presence of brain metastases, baseline ctDNA, co-mutations like P53, it's, you know, each of those is kind of a checkbox that we can think about. And the more of these that patients have, the more likely I am to push, again, in the context of other kind of patient factors. So in and of itself, I think it's not, you know, it's certainly very reasonable, I think, for an L858R patient to receive osimertinib monotherapy, but in the presence of other factors, that might push me.
We had a case that was actually sent in from a physician who wanted to have the case presented to you all. Actually, he would like some assistance with this. Seems like we're talking a lot about young patients nowadays. This is a 49-year-old man, stage 4 disease, exon 19. EGFR ERE746875O deletion. I don't know if that's equal to exon 19 as usual, but goes on osimertinib. We'll show you the scans in a second. And then had relapsed only 8 months after starting for metastatic disease. And he says that at that time, the FLAURA2 trial came out. He relapsed only in the neck. Rest of the areas under control. So he added chemotherapy and kept the osimertinib going. But he knows that there are a lot of other possible decisions. So let me start with you, Alex. You have a patient with an exon 19 deletion who is progressing after 8 months. Doesn't sound like the disease is, you know, in any critical area or massive, but concerning that progression occurred. What would you be thinking about at this point?
So, you know, the thing I usually thought about first is radiation to the site. It's oligoprogression in the neck. You know, I think the reality is, though, it's a neck node, so I would expect this to probably grow back in another contiguous. So here's his original scan. Yeah, I mean, as you can see, this guy had pretty bulky disease, and that's his initial response. I don't know if he's going to share with us the. Oh, there you go. Look at that. So, you know, to me, I mean, it would be, all these are reasonable options. I think radiation is reasonable to the neck nodes. My experience, when it's nodes, you're probably going to get an ipsilateral progression, probably in the mediastinum. You know, you can see it crawling down there pretty fast. And obviously it just doesn't stop in nodes, but I think radiation would be very helpful there. I think certainly adding on chemotherapy right now, or switching to Mariposa 2. We haven't talked yet about that yet. Amulaz is reasonable. And of course, the question that always comes up is getting a biopsy to look for mechanisms of secondary resistance. You know, you can ask everybody, are they going to get a biopsy? Are they getting circulating tumor DNA? Are you going to get both? This is probably something that's really amenable to a biopsy. So I would probably get a biopsy on this and use that in my back pocket as well. But I'd probably radiate this as well. This looks like something the man or the woman is going to be pretty symptomatic from pretty soon. And I'd like to probably double down on preventing pain and symptoms in the neck.
So, Zosha, anything you want to add to this? It's interesting that he kind of views it as, you know, sort of FLAURA2 later, but, you know, actually, normally one of the options would be to start chemotherapy, and then a lot of people would continue the osimertinib, particularly if they're brain mets, and here it's just, well, just keep the osimertinib going. I don't know if that's really basically different. Any thoughts, though, about this case, Zosha?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that's something we've done in our practice for quite some time. You know, when patients progress on a TKI, if we're using chemotherapy, we've often thought about continuing the TKI with the chemotherapy. That is the subject of an ongoing study specifically called the COMPEL trial, where they're looking at chemotherapy plus osimertinib versus chemotherapy plus placebo at progression. So we'll get some more data there, but I think it's very reasonable.
And Posse, you're going to review some later line issues.
So talking about resistance, just to summarize that there are a number of different ways in which cancers can develop resistance to EGFR inhibitors or even other targeted therapies, either by developing a mutation in the drug target like EGFR C797S or T790M, which we don't hear much about these days, developing some other genetic alteration that provides a bypass signaling pathway, MET amplification or HER2 amplification, can also happen through an acquired oncogenic rearrangement like ALK rearrangements and RET rearrangements, et cetera, have been described as resistance mechanisms to EGFR inhibitors. Mutations in further downstream signaling pathways in the RAS, RAF, MAP kinase signaling pathway, PI3 kinase signaling pathway, cell cycle losses. And then as we talked about, not only small cell transformation, but with osimertinib, less so reported for other EGFR TKIs, also squamous cell transformation, which also, of course, would impact your choice of chemotherapy and another reason to do a biopsy rather than a ctDNA where you certainly don't get the information on the histology and where your ability to detect some of these changes, especially copy number gains, is tougher. This is a study that Zosha actually presented at ESMO a couple of years ago, prospectively looking at osimertinib resistance in this clinical trial, and at the genetic level demonstrated that MET amplification and EGFR C797S, the secondary mutation in EGFR, were the two most common mechanisms of resistance. I think important also, an important finding of this trial was the feasibility of doing prospective tumor biopsies was possible in a little over a third of individuals, which recognizes the challenges of this. Sometimes biopsies happen in, progression happens in, unusual or difficult to biopsy locations, or lymph node that's growing next to the aorta, and the interventional radiologists don't feel comfortable biopsying that. So having alternative strategies, ctDNA or epigenetic profiling or other things, are certainly very useful, and hopefully will continue to provide ability to profile tumors non-invasively moving forward. We have some new EGFR inhibitors on the horizon for cancers that develop resistance through an EGFR mutational mechanism, as well as cancers that have atypical EGFR mutations that we talked about a little bit earlier. This just highlights one of them, a compound from Black Diamond Therapeutics called BDTX-1535. In the bottom are shown all the different EGFR mutations and their locations, and showing that this agent can be effective. And on the top left corner, the drug is much more effective against the mutant forms of EGFR compared to the wild type form of EGFR. So it has that similar property as osimertinib, being selective against the mutant forms over the wild type form of EGFR. And that's important because the toxicity of EGFR inhibitors comes from inhibiting the wild type form of EGFR, not the mutant form. And if you just specifically focus on resistance mutations to osimertinib or other third generation EGFR inhibitors shown here in the arrows, you're highlighting the fact that this agent maintains efficacy against these resistance mutations. It is not, however, effective against EGFR T790M. So it's other resistance mutations, C797S, L718Q, others, but not T790M. And this just shows early clinical data in patients that were treated with this agent. And you can see on top there, EGFR mutation, L858R exon 19 deletion. There are resistance mutations in orange. All of here are C797S. The prior lines of therapy are detailed below, and you can see that there are patients that have achieved partial responses and several that have ongoing therapy. So there are potential strategies, if either by ctDNA detection or tumor sequencing, that you can find actionable secondary EGFR mutations and new drugs on the horizon for that. And many of us were familiar with some of the earlier therapies in this space, including the medicines from or drugs from Blueprint Medicines, which were in clinical development but subsequently have ceased clinical development, but don't think also had this degree of clinical activity, at least in the limited data sets that were available. We talked about amivantamab already as a bispecific inhibitor of EGFR and MET, and certainly as a single agent, there is data on amivantamab providing efficacy against EGFR resistance mutations, and also in cases of MET amplification as a resistance mechanism to EGFR inhibitors. Also clinical data with the addition of a MET kinase, MET-directed tyrosine kinase inhibitor, such as tepotinib or capmatinib, added to osimertinib, providing or reinducing responses in patients that have developed MET amplification as a resistance mechanism. The biggest challenge for MET amplification is the definition of MET amplification, as it's not a dichotomous present or absent, it's a range, and those definitions can vary a little bit from trial to trial, so it's important to pay attention to that. But amivantamab in the second line setting has been added to chemotherapy or in combination with lazertinib and chemotherapy compared to chemotherapy and evaluated in this Mariposa phase 3 clinical trial in patients that had the common EGFR exon 19 deletion or L858R mutations who had progressed on or after osimertinib monotherapy as their most recent treatment. And the primary endpoint here was progression-free survival, which was superior for both amivantamab chemotherapy in blue versus chemotherapy in gray, or the triplet in purple versus chemotherapy alone. The lazertinib here didn't really add too much to amivantamab chemotherapy, but almost a doubling of the PFS and a hazard ratio of 0.41. So certainly a clinically meaningful improvement, and amivantamab chemotherapy is now in the NCCN guidelines as an option for post-osimertinib second-line therapy, whereas we previously would have continued or added chemotherapy to osimertinib or switched to chemotherapy. And the trial, as Zosia alluded to, of whether to continue or not osimertinib when adding chemotherapy is ongoing. Here, just a subset analysis showing the combination favors all the subsets, including the L858R mutation at the very bottom and the exon 19 deletion here. Now, the other area of active new therapies that are being developed are, of course, antibody-drug conjugates, which in a way are strategies to deliver, in most cases, highly cytotoxic chemotherapy in a targeted way to cancers that express HER3 or TROP2 or others or HER2. And some of these approaches have been successful and some of them have not. For HER3, the furthest swung along is patritumab deruxtecan, or also known as HER3-DXd. And the reason this is of potential interest is most EGFR mutant cancers express HER3. So this is a way, and HER3 is not a known resistance mechanism at the genetic level to EGFR inhibitors. And so it's a way to specifically deliver something to an EGFR mutant cancer that's independent of the resistance mechanism to osimertinib or other EGFR TKIs. And in the phase 1 clinical trial in the expansion cohort, we learned that the responses occur in almost 40% of individuals with a PFS of about 8.2 months. And the responses occur independently of the resistance mechanism to EGFR TKIs, which you can see on the bottom part. So here, for example, somebody with multiple EGFR resistance mechanism has a response. And here, somebody who, despite biopsying that individual's tumor, just has the original EGFR mutation and yet can develop a response. The challenge with many of our ADCs, including the HER3 one, is we don't have a clear biomarker. And this has been looked at in many of the clinical trials. This is just looking at HER3 IHC, and you can see that regardless of the expression, the best overall response in this color-coded bar graph isn't clearly clustered with the higher level of expression. So patients can have progressive disease who have high levels of HER3 expression. They can have responses who have low levels of HER3 expression. So it's an active area of investigation to try to understand what is the correlate of activity of HER3 or other ADCs. A recent study, the phase 2 study of the HER3 ADC was presented, called the HERTHENA-Lung01 study, presented by Dr. Yu and published in the JCO. Similarly, in patients previously treated with EGFR TKI and platinum-based chemotherapy, had a response rate of about 30%, slightly lower PFS here, 5.5 months, shows also that the activity is independent of the EGFR resistance mechanism, whether it's EGFR dependent, independent, or unknown, and also the activity is independent of the HER3 expression there as well. Perhaps surprisingly, we found in this trial that there that ADCs can have CNS activity as well. And so in this trial, there were 30 patients who had brain metastases at baseline and no prior and who had not received prior radiotherapy. And they had a 33% confirmed ORR. And on the right-hand side, you can see some images of that. So it's not perhaps what we expected from an ADC, which is a big molecule and to get into the CNS, but it was a pleasant thing to be able to see and know that there can be activity in the CNS as well with ADCs. And similar findings have been seen for the HER2 ADCs in HER2 mutant lung cancer. There is an ongoing phase 3 trial of comparing the HER3 ADC, patritumab deruxtecan, to platinum-based combination chemotherapy in patients who have only received EGFR TKIs as their prior therapy. And we hope that the results of this trial will be known sometime during this year, as it will help perhaps position HER3 ADC into the therapeutic armamentarium of treating EGFR mutant lung cancer. There are other ADCs. TROP2 ADC has received the most attention. This is also a transmembrane glycoprotein, highly expressed in non-small cell lung cancer. You can see here on the bottom right, it's a poor prognostic factor in lung cancer. TROP2 targeting datopotamab deruxtecan, and a second one that's been studied and approved in breast cancer, sacituzumab govitecan. And what we've learned over the last year is the data from the TROPION-Lung01 study where Dato-DXd was compared to docetaxel in patients that had previously been treated with systemic therapy, including those with EGFR and other oncogenic alterations, had to have received targeted therapy as well as platinum-based chemotherapy. Dato-DXd was superior in terms of PFS compared to docetaxel. However, an interesting signal was found that it was much better in patients with non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer compared to patients with squamous cell lung cancer, whereas in fact docetaxel seemed better. There has been a dedicated trial looking at Dato-DXd in patients who harbor actionable genomic alterations called the TROPION-Lung05 trial, and Dr. Pazarez presented this at ESMO last year. And here too, you see about a 35% response rate. Interestingly enough, and for reasons that are completely unknown, the response rate appears to be higher in patients with EGFR alterations compared to those with ALK rearrangements. We know that for this agent also, the expression of TROP2 is not an indicator of efficacy. So there clearly are other features that we don't quite yet understand and hope to learn about over the next several years as to what makes therapeutic sense and how to choose individuals for one of these treatments. So I think this is still an area in evolution, and we have targeted combination options. We have chemo or chemo amivantamab versus an ADC. There's some need for biomarkers. And I think it's important to recognize in all of these therapies that for patients with advanced EGFR mutant lung cancer, these are not curative therapies. And we have more work to do here to understand why some EGFR mutant cancers can survive EGFR inhibitors and whether there will be any immune therapeutic approaches for EGFR mutant lung cancers in the future. Our current therapies, such as pembrolizumab and nivolumab, do not really work in patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer.
So I jotted down about 30 questions to ask, but let's take it one at a time, I guess. So first of all, Zosia BDTX1535, I was looking at that presentation from AACR. I think we saw a little bit of it there. I was thinking about this case that we had sent in of the patient who relapsed after 8 months. Any thoughts? Is this like the idea like a better osimertinib? I mean, is the idea that someday this could be first-line therapy, theoretically? Or more in relapse?
My sense is that it's an osimertinib with a broader coverage of certain mutations, resistance mutations, as we saw, and also some activity against atypical mutations. I think the challenge with these drugs right now is that, you know, what we see is that these resistance mutations only arise, as Posse showed, in a relatively small subset of these patients. So if they have, you know, C797S or one of these resistance mutations, the drug is very appealing. But unfortunately, that's not the case for the majority of the patients that we treat. And as a result, I think it makes me, you know, wonder whether, for example, using that drug in the first line setting would truly kind of meaningfully change outcomes if we're only seeing resistance mutations in a small subset of these patients driving resistance.
Yeah, it's unlikely that it would prevent the emergence of MET amplification or small cell transformation or anything else like that.
So what about tolerability, Posse? What do we know about this agent, for example, compared to osimertinib?
It's still early days, I would say, but so far it's been very tolerable, and the degree or the incidence of the sort of on-target EGFR toxicities, rash and diarrhea, has been quite low.
I think it's pretty cool that they're actually seeing responses. That's kind of cool. Let's get back to where we are today, Tom. And curious, again, I don't know what regulatory issues you have to face, but in general, how you're thinking through the common situation, and we just heard about it in the case sentinel of a patient with disease progression after receiving first-line osimertinib, and where do biomarker assays fit in?
Yeah, this is an increasing problem. This is a big problem for us in the clinic today, and it is exciting to see that there are newer agents available at the moment. It's clinical trials that we're also focused on. You know, we've been part of some of these studies, and there is actually several other TKIs that also look pretty good preclinically that are coming to the fore. But there's still some time away, and our current paradigms are really around, firstly, trying to continue patients for as long as possible on whatever therapy they're on. So with that case, we discussed the things that we would typically do, biopsy, try and treat oligoprogressive disease with ablative radiation, add agents such as chemotherapy. And when actually, you know, we're doing this not just with platinum doublet, but we're doing it after that as well. We're adding, you know, docetaxel, for example, to osimertinib.
Let's move on and talk about the cases here. So Posse, you have a 56-year-old man. What happened with him?
So this was a case of a gentleman who presented with a symptom, shortness of breath, with a left upper lobe lung mass, metastatic disease, pleura, mediastinal nodes, adrenal, and bones, and biopsy demonstrated an exon 19 deletion mutation. So he was treated before we had FLAURA2 data. So he started on single agent osimertinib and had rapid symptomatic improvement and an excellent radiographic response that lasted for 15 months. And at that time, a progressive CNS lesion was found on a restaging MRI. He was asymptomatic, but he was treated with SBRT followed by continuation of osimertinib. It's interesting that all the cases that we've talked about, all of them have progressed sooner than the median that's seen in the FLAURA trial. That's a whole, which I think is what we sometimes see in clinical practice. A few months later, progressive liver lesions are found on restaging scans, and he underwent a biopsy that showed the original EGFR exon 19 deletion. Still had adenocarcinoma, but no other new genomic alterations were detected. And the question to the panel is sort of what to, if you had all these options available, I realize that they're not all available, which one would you choose as the next line of treatment based on the data that we have available today?
So, Alex, would you like to tackle this?
So, I like the triplet therapy of carbapenem and amivantamab. It hits all mechanisms of resistance. It's Mariposa 2. It's pretty well tolerated by and large. And for me, that is kind of the answer to all of these right now.
So, Zosia, agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think that chemo amivantamab is a very reasonable choice here. I mean, I think that still chemotherapy plus continuation of osimertinib is a reasonable option as well. You know, this is a patient who had a CNS metastasis, so we want to maximize CNS activity, although I will say in the Mariposa 2 trial, we did see improved intracranial progression-free survival with the combination as well. So I think, you know, we are seeing that amivantamab is adding something here. I would probably discuss, you know, both chemo amivantamab and, you know, chemotherapy plus continuation of osimertinib with the patient. But I agree. I think, you know, the Mariposa 2 data is quite compelling here.
So Pasi, I'm curious, not only about your thoughts about this, but where you see patritumab heading and whether, for example, how you might compare tolerability of patritumab compared to, say, the triplet with ami and chemo.
So we don't have a, of course, regulatory approval for patritumab yet, and we're waiting on the HERTHENA-Lung02 trial results comparing patritumab to combination carboplatin and pemetrexed, and we'll see what comes out of that. It does have a different side effect profile. It has more of a chemotherapy side effect profile, nausea, GI side effects, bone marrow toxicity. It doesn't have the skin toxicity that you see with amivantamab. It does also have an incidence of interstitial lung disease, and which is something to be aware of. And it is being combined with osimertinib in a phase 1, phase 2 trial to address the point that Zosha was making about being able to continue osimertinib in somebody who has a CNS disease. That's an appealing feature, although, as I showed you, there's some activity of patritumab in CNS disease by itself as well. So I think all of those features, CNS disease, availability of agents, pros and cons of side effects, go into that decision making.
Just to clarify, though, this idea of continuing the osimertinib and then adding in the chemotherapy, for how long do you continue the osimertinib? Or does it depend on the CNS history?
I personally continue it throughout chemotherapy and subsequent treatments as well. And especially someone that I know has had CNS metastases and has been those have been treated either with the osimertinib or osimertinib and local therapy. There's a trial, as Zosha mentioned, trying to look at that question specifically. And so we'll actually have some trial data from that at some juncture as well. But I think we're unfortunately also used to seeing patients who stop their EGFR TKI, osimertinib specifically, progress in the CNS, and hence the reason to keep that ongoing.
All right, let's hear about this 48-year-old lady, and maybe Alex can respond about this case.
So this is a lady who presented with, again, more symptomatic disease, has an EGFR L858R mutation. She was given chemotherapy and osimertinib and had symptomatic improvement and excellent response, and lasted here for 22 months, and unfortunately had progressive disease in both the CNS as well as in the liver on restaging, and underwent a biopsy, demonstrated adenocarcinoma, underwent NGS of this biopsy that it demonstrated the original EGFR L858R mutation and also high level of MET amplification on NGS. And here the question really is choosing the subsequent therapy, either local therapy followed by osimertinib or adding a MET inhibitor or other chemotherapies or immune therapy. I guess, Alex, you're on.
Yeah, this is a tough one because there's a lot to do here. I would probably give a trial of capmatinib, trying to avoid CNS toxicity there. It has some evidence of CNS penetration, cross my fingers, although I admit I don't know how long it's going to last. You pointed out the patient has high levels of MET expression, so that I might try that, although I bet you if you go to 5 different oncologists, you'll get 10 different answers.
What did you actually do, Pasi?
Added capmatinib to osimertinib, and there was a response both systemically as well as in the CNS, and which I think capmatinib and tepotinib both have CNS activity. I predominantly myself use capmatinib, but in this situation, I don't like using whole brain radiation therapy either.
All right, let's go on and talk about exon 20. And in a second, Zosia is going to go through the data. But again, just kind of curious, I'll come back to you, Tom, and some of the key questions right now in the management of these patients that come up.
Yeah, exon 20 is a mutation that we're becoming a lot more familiar with, I guess, as we do more and more molecular testing at all stages of disease, and now that there are some active agents in this setting. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the data around using amivantamab plus chemotherapy, for example, but also there are some novel targeted therapies. There's an agent called sunvocertinib, which has come to the phase 3 setting. There are several other exon 20 TKI inhibitors. So we're actually we're at a point now where this is a much more treatable disease. Before, I've seen many patients of second opinions who started on, first, second, third generation EGFR TKIs, who had, no response and progressed straight through. Now that we have some agents that certainly look effective and promising, although in Australia we have we currently don't have access to any of these agents except on clinical trial. But there is certainly a push to try and get patients onto clinical trial. Phenotypically, this is a similar group of patients. These are generally young, female, often Asian ethnicity as well. In a similar situation, hopeful for something that's going to control the disease, and similarly also have a predilection for CNS metastases. So having agents that penetrate the CNS, and there are some agents now available, as well as having better targeted agents, in addition to having the antibody drug conjugates and amivantamab, certainly holds promise in this group of patients going forward.
So let's take a look at the data, Zosia.
Great. So thanks for having me to talk about exon 20 insertions. I think, the first thing to recognize when we talk about EGFR mutant lung cancer is that there's a variety of different EGFR mutations, and it's really important to be clear in your mind and when speaking about these mutations, what type of mutation you're talking about. So the first part of this session was really focused on the classic sensitizing mutations, exon 19 and L858R point mutations. We've also alluded to the fact that there's this additional kind of cohort of atypical but still sensitizing EGFR mutations like L861Q, G719, S768I. All of these are generally sensitive to the currently available EGFR inhibitors, and they're distinct from the EGFR exon 20 insertions. And exon 20 insertions are this heterogeneous cohort of insertion mutations that span amino acid 761 to 775, as you can see in the figure on the right. I will say that these can sometimes be challenging to actually identify correctly on an NGS report if it does not specifically say EGFR exon 20 insertions. So I made this slide for myself as kind of a reference so I could go back and look if I have a, amino acid insertion to try to help understand, is this in exon 20 or exon 19? And always feel free to reach out to the person who issued that report to clarify if you're unsure, because it's so critical to get this right. Exon 20 insertions are best identified on NGS testing is a minor but important point. We know that PCR-based tests miss about half of these. So hopefully everyone's already doing next generation sequencing. But if you're not already, then the correct identification of EGFR exon 20 insertions is a good reason to move in that direction. And as Tom just alluded to, this is a unique subset of mutations that we've seen to be very resistant to earlier generation EGFR inhibitors. Structurally, these are different, and these are quite old studies now that show that these were resistant to drugs like erlotinib and gefitinib, both in vitro and in the clinic. Erlotinib and gefitinib are really ineffective for these patients. And so you know, 5 or 10 years ago, these were really not targetable alterations, except that we knew that we should not treat them the same way that we do the classic EGFR mutations. What about osimertinib for these patients? It has pretty limited activity against structurally, because of the kind of shape and structure of exon 20 insertion specifically, osimertinib does not fit into that binding pocket as well. And we've seen across 2 trials, one that we've led through the ECOG-ACRIN system here in the United States that's still ongoing, and one through from Europe, that osimertinib, even when given at 160 milligrams, so a higher dose to try to really maximize the activity against exon 20, had a pretty low response rate, only 24 to 28%. Some responses that were, you know, that lasted a reasonable long time in our study, the median PFS was 9.6 months, and the European one, 6.8 months, but still much, much lower than what we expect to see with the classic mutation. So osimertinib is generally not something we feel super excited about for these patients. And this is just a brief timeline to show you that really we've seen a lot of activity in the development of drugs for EGFR exon 20 insertions in the past 5 years or so. We had 2 drugs that received accelerated FDA approval, amivantamab, which we've heard about already, but we'll talk a little bit about more. And then the oral EGFR inhibitor, mobocertinib, which also received accelerated approval, but unfortunately was recently withdrawn from the U.S. market. And I'll show you a little bit more data for that. And then along the bottom, I've just shown you some of the agents that are furthest along in clinical development and which have received FDA breakthrough therapy designation. So hopefully are drugs that will move into approval at some point. But currently, as of 2024, actually, we only have available in the U.S. marketplace amivantamab, either alone or with chemotherapy. So amivantamab, I won't belabor the mechanism of action because we've already heard this here, and but I will say that this was actually the first approved therapy for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions. It received accelerated FDA approval in early 2021 for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions who had progressed on prior platinum-based chemotherapy. And that accelerated approval was based on this data here from the Chrysalis study. This is the 81-patient cohort from that initial phase 1 study who received amivantamab monotherapy, and here we saw a response rate of 40% and a median progression-free survival of 8.3 months. So this was really the first kind of targeted therapy success story for EGFR exon 20 insertions and the first drug that came to the marketplace for these patients. We've already talked a little bit about amivantamab toxicities, and I will say that here we're talking about amivantamab monotherapy. A lot of what we discuss when we talk about amivantamab given for classical EGFR mutations is relevant to amivantamab combined with a TKI. But even with amivantamab monotherapy, we do see still a lot of the same toxicities, in particular EGFR-related toxicities like rash and paronychia. You can see that 86% of these patients will have rash, although many of these are low grade. We can see hypoalbuminemia and edema related to MET inhibition. And then, of course, critically, the infusion-related reactions, which are, you know, cumbersome and challenging, require the split dosing and weekly infusions initially. But as we saw at ASCO this year, we likely will see the subcutaneous formulation of amivantamab coming soon. At ASCO this year, we saw the results of a comparison study looking at subcutaneous versus intravenous amivantamab in the Paloma 3 study. Here, this was amivantamab combined in both arms with lazertinib for patients with classical mutations. But what we saw was that pharmacologically, sub-Q amivantamab was non-inferior to intravenous amivantamab, and it had a shorter administration time, less than 5 minutes. It didn't require the split dosing, and as you might expect, this led to higher patient satisfaction and overall improvements in patient quality of life. I will say that infusion-related reactions were clearly less common with this drug, 13% with sub-Q versus 66%, which is consistent with what we've seen with the IV formulation. And so I think it will lead to improvements in the infusion reactions, but it does not affect the frequency of the other toxicities, such as EGFR and MET-mediated toxicities. But likely sub-Q amivantamab will come soon. And then for EGFR exon 20 insertion patients, we had the results of the Papillon study presented at ESMO last year. This was a first-line study that looked at the use of amivantamab in combination with chemotherapy as a first-line treatment for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions. Pretty straightforward study design, 1-to-1 randomization of chemo plus amivantamab or chemo alone with crossover to amivantamab at progression, and the primary endpoint here was PFS. And this was a positive study. We saw a clear improvement in progression-free survival from 6.7 to 11.4 months. Hazard ratio for PFS was about 0.4. The interim analysis for survival was not yet mature, but there was a trend towards an improvement in survival as well. When we look at the safety of chemotherapy plus amivantamab, this is really, I think, taking the toxicities that we've talked about with amivantamab and adding them to the toxicities of chemotherapy. So you see all of the dermatologic, MET-related toxicities, infusion-related reactions with AMI, plus the chemotherapy toxicities like fatigue, myelosuppression, nausea, things like that. But overall, I think what was encouraging is while we did see a fair number of dose reductions, there was a relatively 24% discontinuation. We can argue whether that's low or not. Only 7% of patients did discontinue amivantamab. So I think these are toxicities that for a robust patient can be managed with close monitoring. So all of this data has led the Papillon study now to be added to the NCCN guidelines as a first-line therapy option for patients, amivantamab plus chemotherapy. But I will say that also the NCCN guidelines still also allow the choice of using chemotherapy followed by amivantamab. And in my practice, I think that that's an approach that I might consider for patients who are more frail, where you're really worried about the combination approach with all three drugs up front. Using chemotherapy followed by amivantamab, I think, is reasonable. So what about oral drugs? Briefly to say there's a number of these in development. These have to be uniquely designed to target exon 20 insertions because of the steric hindrance that these insertion mutations cause. And we've seen a number of these drugs in development, including mobocertinib, which we'll talk about in a moment, and then some of the newer drugs, which are now in clinical trials. So mobocertinib, as I already mentioned, was an oral drug that received accelerated FDA approval based on pretty encouraging phase 1-2 data, response rate of about 30%, median progression-free survival about 7 months, but unfortunately fairly high rates of diarrhea and rash, as you can see here. This was then studied in a first-line confirmatory study that was led by Passi and colleagues of the EXCLAIM-2 study. And this study took newly diagnosed patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions. And unlike the Papillon study where amivantamab was added to chemotherapy, here this was mobocertinib monotherapy versus chemotherapy. And the bottom line of this study is that unfortunately it was a negative study. Mobocertinib performed here really, as we might expect, similar to what we'd seen in earlier studies. The median progression-free survival here was 9.6 months. Response rate was about what we'd expect. But the chemotherapy arm also performed quite well, I would say somewhat unexpectedly well for this patient population, with a median PFS of 9.6 months. And as a result, the study was negative. So based on these results, actually, Takeda has voluntarily withdrawn mobocertinib from the United States marketplace because this was their confirmatory study. And so it's no longer available here in the U.S. We do, however, have a number of new drugs that are currently being explored in ongoing phase 1-2, and I'll show you at the end phase 3 studies. Just to highlight a couple of them, the first is zipalertinib, formerly known as CLN-081. This was an oral drug that was, again, specifically developed to target EGFR exon 20 insertions. And in a cohort focusing here on 39 patients treated at the recommended phase 2 dose of 100 milligrams BID, we saw a response rate of 41%. Median PFS was about 12 months. And if we look at the safety, we do still see the same types of toxicities that we saw with mobocertinib and other EGFR inhibitors. But what we're starting to see is that the grade 3 toxicity rates are much lower than we've seen previously. So not toxicity free, but I think we're starting to move in the direction of better tolerance, tolerability. Next, we have sunvozertinib, the drug formerly known as DZD9008. At ASCO this year, Dr. Yang presented some updated data from their ongoing phase 2 study. Again, these were previously treated patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions, 107 patients treated at 300 milligrams daily, and the response rate here was 45%. There was not a median duration of response reached here, but the 9-month disease-free survival rate was 57%. And again, if we look here with the Sunvo data, they presented only the rates of grade 3 or greater treatment-related adverse events in this presentation. And I will note that 17% of these patients did have grade 3 or higher diarrhea. So that's something we'll have to keep an eye on. And about a third of them required dose reduction. But overall, you know, another drug with, I think, relatively lower rates of rash and safety profile that seems to be at least heading in the better direction. And then we have furmonertinib, which is a drug that thus far, I think, has primarily been developed in Asia. This is another selective EGFR exon 20 inhibitor. And here we saw, I think, encouraging data in a cohort of treatment naive patients. This was a small 28-patient cohort. But in the treatment naive setting with furmo, we saw a response rate of 78.6% and a median duration of response of 15 months. And then if we look at previously treated patients, again, small numbers here, but depending on the dose that you look at, the response rate between 38 and 46%. I think these are encouraging data that may suggest that perhaps using this TKI in the frontline setting may have a little bit more activity, which we've seen also with some other targeted therapies. And again, looking at treatment naive patients, if we look at toxicities, high grades of, you know, diarrhea and things like that, but very few grade three or greater adverse events. So again, I think some signs that we are moving in a better direction in terms of safety and tolerability. I think, you know, there are ongoing phase three studies with all of these, I think, with notably different study designs. So with the Cullinan drug, we see the combination of zipalertinib plus chemotherapy compared to chemotherapy alone, whereas with sunvozertinib and furmonertinib, they're monotherapy trials. And of course, we'd love to see a TKI-only combination if it can beat chemotherapy here. And then I think another key point is going to be the CNS activity of these agents. And we've really seen very little data presented thus far, only anecdotal cases of these. As was alluded to earlier, there are some drugs in earlier development, still in early phase one testing, which are developed to have better CNS activity, such as ORIC-114, but we haven't yet seen much to see how that will translate into clinical practice. So I'll leave the summary here for all of you to read. But I think the key point here is that we have to identify these mutations as different than the classic EGFR mutations to be able to apply these treatment paradigms for these patients. And really, I think, to think about clinical trials for patients who are able to travel for them right now.
So just to clarify something you said in the beginning that's kind of concerning, are you saying that maybe that some NGS reports are not clear? They don't use the word exon 20. They just put the letters and numbers, and that maybe it's actually getting missed by the doc?
Yes, I think I've seen that quite a bit.
Good.
And I would say not, you know, from large companies and even, you know, from in-house testing in my own institution and others, they're not always, you know, clear. And sometimes it can be really hard to say, well, you know, is H771, is that an exon 20 or exon 19? That can be challenging to read. So yes, I've definitely seen that.
All right, let's take a look at your cases, beginning with this 48-year-old man.
Yep. And both of these cases are, you know, really focused on kind of first, second line therapy here and cases from my practice. So this is a 48-year-old, no history of tobacco use, no really significant past medical history, who had several weeks of dyspnea and cough, was found to have a right pleural effusion on x-ray, as you can see, and then on chest CT was found to have this pleural effusion, pleural nodules, and a 6-centimeter right perihilar lung mass. The PET scan showed a right adrenal metastasis, and a brain MRI was obtained and was also negative. So the patient underwent a diagnostic procedure with a right VATS and pleural biopsy, as well as a talc pleuritesis to try to manage the pleural effusion at the same time. The pathology from the pleural biopsy showed lung adenocarcinoma. And this was one of these cases where the NGS report came back with this N771H773 duplication, as well as a concomitant P53 mutation and PD-L1 high, 80%. So I've gone back to my little table that I've made for myself as a reference, and you can see that this falls into exon 20. So this was an exon 20 insertion for this patient. So maybe I'll pause here and say, because the next step is, you know, what we did for this patient. So newly diagnosed patient now with EGFR exon 20 insertions. I think, you know, in my practice, the Papillon data is compelling. And for a young and healthy patient like this, I personally would lean towards the combination of chemotherapy and amivantamab. But maybe we can ask the others how they feel about adopting that.
You know, let me ask Alex, but also Alex, can you comment on the issue of IOs with exon 20? You know, we've heard the story in terms of classical mutations, but I'm not sure I know much about exon 20 and IO. She's got this patient has a TPS of 80%.
Yeah, so for me, I would agree With Zosia, I would definitely give Papillon, Carbapem, AMI at this point. The patient's young and healthy, and we want the patient to get all targeted therapy. You know, we don't have the data like we do in typical EGFR mutations, but biologically, I'm not sure there's a reason I would think about this any differently than a classical EGFR mutation. So I would shy away from it. I don't think it's technically wrong. The biggest concern with the classical EGFR mutations are patients that got OC, they got checkpoint inhibitor, then got osimertinib and developed pneumonitis. We don't have as robust data here, but based upon all the studies, many of those patients would have gotten prior IO, and we haven't seen any issues. But I would not give it in combination. So if you're going to give the patient amivantamab, I would give the patient carbapem AMI at this point.
It's amazing how often, in spite of talking about things, it seems like a million times that I don't hear stuff or we don't bring out things that are really important. I'm really curious, in general, what do you think a doc in practice would do with this kind of report? Do you think they would treat it with osimertinib, ignore it, or any thoughts, Zosia?
I think we could probably all tell stories of patients we've seen in consultation. I think my hope is that through programs like this, you know, a doc like this will know to ask either the doctor who issued the report or to reach out to, you know, someone who, you know, a thoracic oncologist to ask for advice, because it's really complicated. I've seen all of the above done, you know, and sometimes they'll just throw up their hands and say, I don't know, maybe this isn't relevant, I'll just give them chemo. Sometimes they'll say, I see GFR and I'll treat with osimertinib, but it's really complicated.
Alex, they need your little handy table.
docs, they're taking care of myeloma and, you know, CLL and everything else. And my first guess is that they see something like that, they might ignore it. It doesn't say, you know, exon 19 or L885R. They probably would think it's some kind of, you know, weird mutation that maybe wouldn't respond. I don't know. But definitely an important teaching point. Let's continue, though.
All right. So, indeed, I chose to treat this patient with a chemotherapy plus amivantamab, the Papillon study. The patient overall did okay, although he did have an infusion-related reaction, as we expect, and then over time also developed some pretty significant scalp folliculitis and some dermatologic toxicities. But fortunately, as you can see with these pictures, he's had a nice response on scans with a decreased right lung mass and pleural nodules, and right now remains stable. But I think that, you know, the question that we've already started to discuss in the clinic is, what do we do for this patient subsequently, you know, and what will be the next line of therapy? And, you know, we're in this difficult situation right now where we don't have an approved oral agent for these patients. Currently, it's hard when we previously had mobocertinib and it's no longer available. So certainly I think enrollment on a clinical trial is the preferred approach for a patient like this. And there's a number of them ongoing, but, you know, for your audience, I imagine sometimes there are patients where that may not be, you know, as easy to do. And so I think it's a challenging situation.
So just kind of curious, Posse, I see these new agents coming along. Anyone in particular that you're excited about, or they sort of look similar at this point?
I think the data on sunvozertinib and zipalertinib are relatively similar. And there are others, as Zosia mentioned, out there as well. And we hope that one or both of those would receive accelerated approval at some point, so we'd have a TKI option available for patients who need something after the Papillon regimen. This is also a population of patients that could potentially benefit from ADCs. It hasn't really been extensively studied in the EGFR exon 20 patients, although there were one or two in the patritumab phase 1 clinical trial and had some minor responses. So that's something to keep in the back of our mind as well as another option moving forward.
That's a really interesting thought. So I always love cases that start with 85-year-old. Let's hear what happened with this lady.
So this is a patient, actually, I recently saw for a second opinion, 85-year-old with a history of tobacco use, some other comorbidities, including coronary artery disease, diabetes, importantly with associated renal insufficiency, and some neuropathy who presented with chest pain and on CT and PET imaging was found to have a 3 centimeter left upper lobe lung mass, metastases to the mediastinal lymph nodes, sternum, and the iliac bones. And then on brain MRI also was found to have a small left parietal metastasis measuring about 8 millimeters with some edema. And so the patient underwent endobronchial ultrasound and a biopsy of a paratracheal lymph node, which showed adenocarcinoma, in this case PD-L1 negative, but again with an EGFR exon 20 insertion, this in this case the S768D770 duplication on molecular testing. Now, this patient unfortunately has a creatinine of 1.8 and a creatinine clearance of 32 and somewhat limited functional status in light of age. And so I think this is a challenging situation. The patient and her family came and said, we really want to explore treatment options. You know, we know that this is potentially a targetable alteration. What can we, you know, what would be the best treatment? And so I thought this was an interesting case. The brain metastasis also, I think, poses a particular challenge for a patient like this.
So Tom, any thoughts? And are there situations where you'd hold off on, let's say, whole brain radiation and try systemic therapy with the patient with exon 20 and brain mets?
Yes, it would depend on the clinical situation. I think this person, I don't think you mentioned if they were symptomatic, Zoshia, but with the edema, you know, you'd certainly be concerned.
No, they weren't symptomatic.
Okay. So this is someone that, is not going to get onto a clinical trial. And that's the difficulty. For us, I don't have access to, the Papillon, agents. So, you know, I would be thinking of, either, you know, chemotherapy or, supportive care alone. If I had access to amivantamab, this would be a very difficult patient to treat with that regimen. Just with the creatinine, the ECOG performance status of 2. So I think I would struggle to go down that path. If I had access to a TKI, that would be my preferred, even though none of the ones that we've presented so far have got great CNS data behind them, and this person does need CNS response. So if you were going to go down that path, you would probably need to think about some cranial radiation as well. And the other thing to say with this person is it's not the phenotype that you typically associate with EGFR, given that they're a smoker. It's possible that this is subclonal. You know, if you had a little bit more, you know, sequencing on the tumor, that might help you, but, you're still not going to be rushing into giving anything systemic, such as chemoimmunotherapy regardless. So, it's a very difficult situation.
So, Palsy, second opinion.
I agree with Tom. I probably think about it, some sort of SBRT to the brain lesion if there's surrounding edema and symptoms from that. I think the creatinine and the creatinine clearance make giving the Papillon regimen a bit of a challenge, and also would probably exclude her from a clinical trial of a TKI as well. Often with that kind of creatinine clearance as well as the functional status. So it's a tough one. Could potentially do single agent chemotherapy. Not eligible really for single agent amivantamab because it hasn't had prior treatment. So I think it's a real challenge.
So everybody's really curious to know what happens, Osha.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talked through all of this and we discussed the options of, you know, supportive care, which I think would be certainly very reasonable for a patient like this. Or, you know, we also discussed trying to get single agent amivantamab approved in a patient considered chemotherapy ineligible, essentially, and seeing if that would be approved. I think a key point here is that I would not expect amivantamab to have much CNS penetration in a patient like this. So I think I would still favor, you know, SRS radiation to that lesion if we were going to go down the road of amivantamab. And I will say, I think amivantamab, even as a single agent for an 85-year-old with limited functional status, can be challenging, the infusion-related reactions and the side effects. So, you know, we talked through that and the patient and family we're going to consider and follow up with their local oncologist, but we're leaning towards supportive care.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Striving for Consensus, Current and Future Management of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer in Patients with EGFR Tumor Mutations.